Hello, this is Dick Estelle. I'm continuing the reading of the book called The Great Northern Express today. It was written by Howard Frank Mosier and published by Crown Publishers of New York in the year 2012. Mosier was telling us about meeting this woman, Marjorie Moore. She was a big, good-looking woman, friendly blue eyes. She owned a farm on the Willoughby River. And she said that any time you young folks can come over and fish or hunt, any time you want to, and if you ever need anything at all, just give me a shout. Marjorie was certainly kind of heart and also extremely helpful to all human beings. And he said soon after I met her, she poached a well-fed doe in the next county over to help see her five children through the winter. She dressed the out-of-season deer in a man's overcoat, a scarf, and a slouch hat, and then propped it in the front seat of her car with just the tip of its black snout sticking out between the scarf and the downturned brim of the hat. And sure enough, the game warden was waiting for her at the county line. Unable to find any evidence of wrongdoing after searching her car, he angrily asked why she was laughing. Had she been drinking? No, she said, but her cousin here, slouched up against the passenger door, had taken one nip of Applejack too many, whereupon the warden brusquely told her to get her drunken relative home to bed where he belonged. A few weeks later, when the Orleans Bank was robbed, the local constabulary went too far by fingering Marjorie as a person of interest in their investigation. So she decided it was time to make a statement. And first she marched into the bank and announced in a voice loud enough to be heard two townships away that she would very much like to rob it. This august institution had recently seen fit to turn down her application for a $200 loan, but she doubted that the bank had enough cash on hand to make it worth her while. The police stepped up their investigation and began appearing at her farm to question her at all hours of the day and night. So it was time for phase two of our friend's plan. She hinted to a neighbor woman, who was a notorious gossip, that maybe she did know something about the bank robbery after all. And, just maybe, the loot was buried behind her barn under the towering manure pile that she had wanted gone for 30 years, but lacked the wherewithal to have it moved. Only in the kingdom would the cops fall for this ruse, showing up at the Moore place at 3 o'clock one morning with backhoe and bulldozer. And Margie got her manure pile moved all right, and at the bottom, the police discovered what one usually discovers at the bottom of a manure pile, and not one thing else. Chapter 42. The Howard of Moses Lake. Moses Lake, the sign announced, the oasis of eastern Washington. And on the day I arrived, the oasis of eastern Washington looked as arid as the Gobi Desert. I parked downtown and trudged through the most oppressive heat that I had encountered since leaving home. It was not yet 9:30 and already 100 degrees in the shade. And I went into a small and blessedly air-conditioned bank to cash a traveler's check. While I waited in line for a teller, a man about my age came through the door, weaving a little bit, and he hollered out, "I'm here for my monthly withdrawal." And one of the three tellers said with exaggerated patience, as if she were speaking to an overtired child, "You can't make your withdrawal until the end of the week. You know that, Howard." Howard, I thought. Howard shouted, "I need it now. N-O-W. I'm having a sugar attack. I've got to buy my medication." The trio of tellers looked at one another and rolled their eyes, and the oldest teller said, "Howard, Howard, Howard, come back on Friday. As you can see, we are very busy this morning." Well, this didn't seem right. They were denying this poor diabetic an advance on whatever stipend they were supposed to disperse to him. And I started to say, "See here, but just then Howard looked at me. I could have sworn he winked. In stentorian tones, he bellowed, "I'm feeling a spell coming on. Yeah, here she comes. Here she comes. I'm going to loud up. Look out again. I'm going to fall down. And I'm going to get rowdy again." Maybe it was that word again that did the trick. As the Howard of Moses Lake started to flap his arms spastically and lurch and stagger, the head teller capitulated. She said, "This is the last time, Howard, the very last time." So it's 5 minutes later, and I'm at the mini-mart next door, filling the thirsty tank of the loser cruiser. Standing at the clicking pump, daydreaming of cabbages and kings and my friend Howard, I noticed a new white 3/4-ton pickup parked in the handicap slot in front of the convenience store. And on the shiny, outsized rear bumper, beside the license plate displaying the familiar wheelchair symbol, a sticker declared, "I'd rather be fishing." Well, that made sense. So would I. But as I replaced the nozzle and twisted the rusted gas cap back on, charging out of the store came, dear God, the Howard of Moses Lake. He was toting a 24-pack suitcase carton of Bud, the King of Beers, in each hand. And without breaking stride, Howard heaved first one case and then the other over the tailgate into the bed of the white pickup. And then he turned, winked at me again, and he said, in the voice of a man who knows exactly how he's going to spend the rest of the day, and very probably the rest of his life, he said, "I got my medication. Now I can go fishing." Chapter 43, Sacagawea. How my Uncle Reg would have loved this Howard of Moses Lake, I thought. Reg's unpublished and now missing History of Chichester had been full of colorful scamps, and I had no doubt that Howard would have fit right in. There were ghost stories in my uncle's manuscript as well, and my favorite one began with the loud footsteps on the porch of the house where the ox driver John Everett had murdered his wife Jenny with an axe for a love affair she had not had. And the footfalls, everyone in Chichester had heard them, even the village doctor, the footfalls were believed to be those of the curiosity seekers who gathered on Everett's porch after the murder to view Jenny's bloody corpse through the front windows. Like my storytelling uncle, I've always been deeply skeptical of and yet fascinated by tales of the supernatural. Back in the late 1990s, when I was out west researching my Lewis and Clark novel called The True Account, I had planned to see the famous fountain statue of Sacagawea at the junction of the Clearwater and Snake Rivers on the Washington-Idaho border. I missed seeing it on that trip, so this time I decided to swing down. It was no more than 60 or 70 miles out of my way. Go there and pay my respects to the remarkable woman without whose assistance the greatest expedition of exploration in American history might well have ended in disaster somewhere in the Rockies. Late in the morning, I stopped at a pull-off beside the Clearwater to ask directions. Sitting on a grassy berm between the rest area and the river was an elderly Native American woman. She wore a plaid skirt and blouse, moccasins beaded blue and red, and a fringed shawl figured with elk, deer, and salmon. As I approached her, I realized that she was more than elderly. She was ancient. She was the oldest person I had seen since leaving home, perhaps close to 100, and yet marvelously alive-looking, full of a serene vitality, with the kindest face imaginable. She said to me, "You're a long way from home." And I wondered if she had spotted my green Vermont license plate on the loser cruiser's rear window, but I didn't see how. The cruiser was tucked out of sight below the berm. She was gazing out over the river in the other direction. I said, "Yeah, about 3,000 miles, but this is beautiful country." We continued to visit for a few minutes. I asked about the local fishing and then inquired about the statue. And my friend told me it was about another mile or so to the west. And I wondered, if she had lived here all of her life. She said, "Not yet." Like the old Vermonter in the story Mark Twain liked to tell. But her Nez Perce ancestors had lived in that area for, 10,000 years or so. And again, I was struck by the light in her eyes and by her regal beauty. I have noticed that women who are especially kind often retain their beauty throughout their lives. But you can't really say that to someone you've just met, and judging by the care she took with her appearance, I was sure she knew it anyway. So I thanked her for the directions, and I returned to my car. The fountain statue was fully as striking as I had heard. Unlike the older, rather heavy-set Sacagawea outside the Capitol building in Bismarck, North Dakota, this Sacagawea was a pretty, slender teenager. Water flowed over her fingertips, splashing into a basin. And sitting beside the statue, looking out over the river, was that elderly Nez Perce woman that I had just met upriver. The same figured shawl, plaid skirt and blouse, blue and red beaded moccasins, and the same radiant beauty. I wondered, how did she get there? Did she fly, like the old woman who taught Blue Duck to fly in Lonesome Dove? Was she perhaps Sacagawea herself? Unwilling to demystify the experience, I returned to my car and headed north to my event in Spokane. Some stories should simply be left to stand alone, like the statue of that brave and beautiful young mother and American heroine overlooking the junction of two great western rivers. Chapter 44. Spring Comes to the Kingdom, Part 1. My only brush with the unaccountable took place during our first year in the kingdom at about the time that spring began to creep north into the Green Mountains. The earliest harbinger of warmer weather in northern Vermont may be the shift in the blue jay's call from a harsh, hawkish cry to what the naturalist Roger Torrey Peterson described as a musical queedle-queedle. In 1965, the big showy jays we fed in Verna's dooryard began their queedling in late February. A month later, when sugaring operations were in full swing in the maple orchards around Burlington and Montpelier, the kingdom's sugar bushes were still locked tight in 4 feet of snow. By the second week of April, the sap had finally started to run up north. And once again, as on the first day of deer season, our classrooms emptied out. In that pre-plastic pipeline era, farm kids were recruited to tap trees, lug sap buckets, and help with barn chores while their parents sugared off. Rose-tinted clouds of steam lifted high over the bare black maple trees in the sunset. There were sugar-on-snow parties to attend, wild bobsled rides down Allen Hill. My seniors and I read Ethan Frome, and when we came to the tragic sliding accident, we talked about whether some people were trapped by their circumstances. I assured the kids that not one of them was trapped, and I hoped that was true. We went to kitchen tunks or junkets at the homes of our French-Canadian students, and while the sap boiled in the sugar houses, we danced and hummed and clapped the night through the music of the champion fiddler, Wild Bill Royer. A pair of clacking dessert spoons he heard, and we feasted on tautière, and though it wasn't Christmas, the traditional frosted log cake, while grandmother told tales of the fearsome loup-garou, the werewolf of the deep forest just over the border, who lured unsuspecting travelers to their deaths in the wilderness, and of the three ghostly fishermen and the little blue virgin of Quebec. About half of our students could claim French-Canadian ancestry on at least one side of the family. Perhaps a quarter still spoke French at home. As spring approached, Phyllis marched down to the Orleans slaughterhouse and returned with a few cow hearts and lungs for her biology class to dissect. She took her kids on expeditions along the Willoughby River, and showed them how to identify skunk cabbage and wild ginger and bloodroot and coltsfoot and spring beauties. She helped them assemble entries for the county science fair and taught them the periodic table and how their own smart brains worked. My own teaching improved a little. I was learning what to expect from my students, although I didn't expect Bill the Brain to say when I asked what they thought was the practical use of the stone wall in Frost's mending wall that divided the narrator's pines from his neighbor's apples. Bill said, well, it might keep him from getting pineapples. Bill had just gotten a full scholarship to Middlebury. Queedle, queedle. In general, the more I asked of the kids, the better they did. And by dint of their own hard work, they were writing pretty passable essays on Othello and Hamlet. And then came hopeful news of my own. Coming down the stretch on my master's thesis on Shakespeare's villains, I learned that I had received a teaching fellowship to pursue my Ph.D. in Elizabethan literature at the University of Pennsylvania. And I wondered why I wasn't more excited. On the first day of trout season, with plenty of snow still in the woods, I assembled my fly rod and drove to a brook a few miles north of Marjorie Moore's farm on the Willoughby River. I wasn't surprised to discover that my chosen stream was still frozen in places. It would be tough to cast, tough to avoid spooking the trout in the icy crystalline water. But I tied a small red-and-white coachman fly onto a light leader and headed upstream into the snowy forest, just as Dad and Uncle Reg and I used to do on opening day on that little mountain stream running down through Ox Clove into the ghost town of Chichester. Though I had to creep along more like a hunter than a fisherman, stalking the few open pools so the trout wouldn't see me, I immediately felt the incomparable sense of well-being that I've experienced in the woods ever since early childhood. In a stand of still leafless poplars, I passed a cellar hole marked by a lilac bush not yet in bud. Nearby, a Model A sat rusting on its wheel rims. Ages ago, someone had tried to make a go of a farm here and then given up. But the little native trout were as lovely as ever, with emerald backs and flaming speckles, and even in the early spring of 1965, within a few miles of the new ski resort being built at Jay Peak, the only tracks I saw were those of a single river otter, which had fished up the stream a few hours ahead of me. Suddenly, I pulled up short, overcome by a sensation of foreboding. It came as unexpectedly as a thunderclap out of the still wintry Vermont sky, and it somehow seemed to be connected with the murmur of the brook. At first, I couldn't put a name to it. I tried to continue fishing, but I was overwhelmed by a physical sickness, similar to the sickening horror that has come over me when I've seen old footage of World War II concentration camps. I hurried away from that stream, toward a hardwood ridge, found a deer trail that eventually turned into an ancient lumbering trace, and just at sunset came out on the road about a half a mile from my car. But 20 minutes later, I was still shaken, and I drove down the mountain toward Marjorie's. Marjorie ushered me into her kitchen for coffee, and I told her about my eerie experience up in the woods, which reminded her of a tale about a first cousin whose home had been willed to her by an elderly maiden aunt. The place was rumored to be haunted by the ghost of a handsome young dress peddler who, during the Depression, visited Orleans for a few days each year and boarded with the aunt. The peddler, a natty dresser with flashy two-tone shoes, drove a shiny black Model T Ford, new each year. One year, he failed to show up, though for the past several months, the aunt, wearing a different new dress each Sunday, had driven to church in a new Ford. The sheriff came calling, but the aunt was not one to brook impertinent inquiries, and she smiled thinly and said that the peddler had left his car and wares with her, and assuring her he'd be back in a few days, had taken the train north to Canada. That was the last that she had seen of him. Time passed, and eventually the aunt herself passed, from her irreproachable status as a maiden lady to narrower confines in the resting place of her ancestors. And as for Marjorie's cousin, some years after moving into the house she had inherited from her famously straight-laced aunt, she removed a downstairs partition, and inside the wall she discovered a skeletal human foot and part of an ankle in a two-tone shoe. Some of Marjorie's tales were even darker. Not far from her farm, she said, a haunted house used to stand alone in the woods near a brook. And when she was a girl, a couple from town rented the place, but they were frightened away by specters. Some years later, as Marjorie approached the empty house with a horse and wagon, she noticed a woman searching for something in the overgrown dooryard. And as the wagon drew closer, the horse reared up and bolted, and the woman vanished. Marjorie told me he was a good, steady horse. He never would have shied at the sight of a common person. I said this wasn't a common person. She said it was the ghost of an alleged murderess. Marjorie waited while I dug out my notebook. She said her husband was a laudanum addict. It was widely believed that one day when he was doped up, she took him out near the brook and killed him by pouring an entire bottle of the stuff down his throat. Well, some years later, the town father sent a local foster girl out to board with the woman and her grown son. My grandfather knew that the girl was being mistreated, and more than once he'd seen her out doing chores barefoot in the snow. He reported the incidents, but nothing was done. And a few months later, the girl turned up dead. I was writing real fast now, and I said to Marjorie, "Dead from what?" "Blows to the stomach." The coroner ruled that she was pregnant and had been killed by repeated blows to the stomach. Somehow, the woman and her son got out of it at the trial, but not long afterward, the son committed suicide. So for the second time that day, I felt sick, imagining the defenseless girl, the psychopathic woman, and her brutal son in that terrible, remote place. Marjorie went on to say, after the son killed himself, the woman went mad, and she spent the rest of her life ranting. I said, what, from guilt? Oh, yeah, probably. But the form it took was unusual. She claimed that the sound of the nearby brook had become unbearable to her. First it made her sick, then it drove her insane. I sat forward in my chair and I said, what brook? Do you remember? Marjorie didn't know its name, but offered to draw a map in my notebook. Painstakingly, she penciled in the mountain road leading north from her farm, the old haunted house, and there the nearby brook. It was the stream that I had fished that afternoon. Just before leaving Marjorie's place that chilly April night, I asked her a final question. I said, what was that woman's name, the supposed murderess? Marjorie said, but then she just shook her head. She said, I think who she really was evil personified. Chapter 46, Big Sky Country. The West Texas Jesus boasted to me one morning on our way through the mountains to my event in Missoula. I could spin a tall tale myself back in my heyday. We were following Clark Fork, one of the most beautiful trout streams in the West. My guy was eyeing it, spooling along in the valley 1,000 feet below us through a series of deep green pools, whitewater rapids, and trouty-looking runs of broken water. I said, back in your heyday? By now I wasn't sure whether he was talking about playing steel guitar and singing backup for Marty Robbins in a roadhouse in El Paso City, or telling stories from a mountaintop in Galilee. And then, trouble. I'd been expecting it for the past week or so. It had been building day by day, and frankly, I was surprised it hadn't come to a flashpoint sooner. Since Austin, Texas, Reg and the West Texas Jesus had been arguing about everything under the sun. Back in Northern California, in a motel near Mount Shasta, they had argued over whether the Catskills were true mountains of the remains of an eroded plateau. Reg said that the New York State history text that he had used with his kids at the one-room school in Chichester explained in detail that the Catskills were an eroded plateau. But the West Texas Jesus said that for his money, a mountain was a mountain, period. In Oregon, I had spent the better part of an afternoon listening to them hash over the earth-shattering question of whether an eastern brook trout was a true trout or a char. Red said, "A char." Jesus averred that a trout was a trout was a trout, and on they jangled until I thought I'd go crazy. This morning in western Montana, all of their wrangling came to a head over baseball. That's right, not religion, not politics, not fish. Baseball. And what got them started was the old debate over whether a pitched baseball actually curved or only appeared to. Reg took the affirmative, and while I think the West Texas Jesus probably knew better, he claimed that it was all an optical illusion. Reg said, "Get a bat. We'll settle this at the next ball diamond we come to." Jesus said that he could put any pitch in Reg's repertoire over the wall. And since there was no way to settle this latest hoo-ha immediately, my traveling companions fell into a sullen silence. Below, as we continued east through the Rockies, at least we could all agree that these 10,000-foot-high peaks were not the remains of a plateau, the Clark Fork ran cold, fast, and clear. The West Texas Jesus said, "Let's wet a line," and we dipped down toward the river. He said, "Pull into that fishing access, Harold." I said, "I've got a 1 o'clock in Missoula." I said, "Come on, we'll sink a six-pack in the river. Fish up. Walk back down. Catch us some trout. Drink some ice-cold beer." I said to him again, "I have an event in Missoula." Well, the West Texas Jesus swore and said, "I'm going fishing." I said, "Wait just a minute. I never did get to tell you about that unfinished business with my uncle." But he was already headed down over the bank toward the river, six-pack in one hand, fly rod in the other, a fly rod very much resembling the split bamboo 7.5-foot Orvis that my grandparents gave me when I graduated from college. I thought he called something over his shoulder as he started fishing up the river, and I caught the words "about it." I wondered about what? I had no idea. But the last I saw of the West Texas Jesus in the rearview mirror, he was tied into a good fish, and his rod, bent and throbbing, his beer can lifted exuberantly, while the loser cruiser and I puttered on toward home and my reunion with Phyllis. Chapter 47, Missoula. On my way back to the cruiser after my event that afternoon in Missoula, I said, "About face." And sitting on the sidewalk was a ragged young man with a pack of tarot cards fanned out in front of him. I said, "I'll give you $5 if you'll answer one question for me, and all you have to say is yes or no." Well, my five spots seemed to vanish as I held it out toward him. I said, "Okay. I'm a writer, on a book tour, and what I'd really like to do is stay right here in Montana and fish for a week. Should I?" And our half hour is over again. I'm reading The Great Northern Express by Howard Frank Mosier, published by Crown Publishers of New York, 2012. Funding for this program given to us by this and other National Public Radio stations. Until next time, from Michigan State, this is Dick Estelle.